Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the L.A. Steel Show. Leo and Lila is joining us right this minute.
I'm right here. Good evening, folks. Here on this.
Yeah, we can't.
Spring evening. If you turn on the light, we'll be able to see.
That is an issue that we have this evening, my co-host, darling. We have our light's out, so I brought this here. And
put a new bulb in.
There's no bulb for those. They're out of a bulb. It just broke.
What do you mean it just broke?
The cat tipped it over, and the light bulb broke. You're hearing this for the first time right here on L.A. Steel Show. So anyway, we are going to be reading in the dark.
I don't think that's possible.
It is possible. Trust me. And we're not reading in the dark. We have a computer screen in front of us, and we have other alternative lighting, but not the desk light, unfortunately. So, let me see if I can find something here that has large writing. Well, I thought this was a good article. I don't know if you feel up to reading it, but this was a very good article. And I really like that article.
This is Down the Memory Hole by Alan Greenspan, Alan Greenspan Style by Stephen Lindemann. And it's from Global Research. He's back and in denial in a March 11th Wall Street Journal co-op-ed headline. The Fed didn't cause the housing bubble. He lied the way he did through his career and for 18 and a half years as the Fed chairman. How else could he have kept the job? Be knighted in the UK for his contribution to global economic stability, wisdom and skill, and then afterwards be extolled by the money trust he enriched. So now he's preserving his legacy by expunging its dark side the way Orwell described in 1984, Down the Memory Hole. A convenient slot for any document due for destruction, but politically inconvenient truths to be erased to preserve only sanitized versions for the public. It's called historical revisionism, but even some on the right aren't convinced. The Ludwig von Mises Institute is a libertarian research and educational center espousing the Austrian school economics of its namesake. Robert Murphy is one of its adjunct scholars. In an April 14, 2008 article, he asked, "Did the Fed cause the housing bubble?" "The case is straightforward," he stated. Greenspan slashed the federal funds target from 6.5% in January 2001, down to a ridiculous 1% by June 2003. After holding rates at 1% for a year, the Fed then steadily ratcheted them back up to 5.25 by June 2006, a pumping and popping process that seemed to be more than just coincidence. It led to speculative malinvestments, then needing a recession to correct. The Fed's role in the housing boom and bust is a classic illustration of the Austrian business cycle theory, according to Murphy. Indeed, the Misesian explanation is so compelling that more and more economists and financial analysts are being persuaded, but not Greenspan, who made his own case and got the Wall Street Journal to publish it. The problem is what he said, even worse, what he admitted, that as Fed chairman, he led a pump-and-dump scheme, a financial coup d'etat to defraud the public for Wall Street. It continues unabated with new schemes, sucking trillions of dollars of wealth from the many to the few through fraudulently engineered housing, asset, and debt bubbles, illegally offshoring vast sums of capital globally, and shifting government assets to private interests, then their liabilities onto the government, leaving the taxpayer stuck with the bill. Across the board, his Fed tenure outraged William Grader enough to call him one of the most duplicitous figures ever in modern American government, who used his position to corrupt the political dialogue, to sell snake oil to Congress, and the public, and be a willing co-conspirator in the truth of trillions going back to the early 1980s through his Fed days. He championed derivatives, securitization, and deregulation. He believed unfettered markets worked best, so let them, and told Congress and committee in the mid-1990s. Risks in financial markets, including derivative markets, are being regulated by private parties. There is nothing involved in federal regulation, per se, which makes it superior to market regulation. In other words, let capital operate freely, plunder at will, and have no regulatory restraints, regardless of the harm caused. He sanctioned fraud as a tool of the money trust, and as Fed chairman, engineered multiple bubbles in stocks, housing, mortgages, bonds, derivatives, currencies, and commodities, yet took no responsibility for the fallout. When asked, he said he has no regrets on any of the Federal Reserve policies that we initiated. In fact, he championed them. He let house prices become an $8 trillion wealth bubble, yet he had regulatory authority to prevent it. He chided his critics, ignored the public interest, and even encouraged use of risky no-down payment adjustable rate mortgages, including subprime ones, at the worst possible time to buy property. He bears full responsibility for the greatest ever economic collapse, costing millions their homes, jobs, savings, pensions, and futures. Yet he has no regrets for any of his actions. Here's his account of the housing bubble with a warning to the unwary. Take a strong dose of antacid before reading. Greenspan admits that the lower interest rates spawned the speculative euphoria rate what matters was not the federal funds rate. It was the rate on the long-term fixed-rate mortgages. The correlation between home and mortgage rates was highly significant and a far better indicator of rising home prices than the Fed funds rate. While it's true that longer rates affect mortgage ones, as important is how investors view the economy and prospects for inflation. In addition, short rates affect all others. They influence longer rates, including treasury notes, bonds, and mortgages. Markets set all rates except one, fund rates. But it's the prime mover for others with added power from its central bank's bully pulpit. Significant also is the close correlation between mortgage and Fed fund rates. The average spread from 1971 to 2002, the average spread between them was 2.85%. Thereafter, the relationship changed for a reason, because Fed funds fell so low while mortgage rates bottomed out around 5.75 and didn't top 6% again until the Fed target rate approached 4%. If 2.85% had held, 30-year mortgages would have been sub 4%. Today, at 0% Fed funds, 30-year mortgage rates are around 5%. And take note, historically, the lowest ever in the 20th and 21st century mortgage rate was around 4.7% right after World War II. However, in the wake of the Fed's announced intention to buy $1.25 trillion in Freddie and Fannie mortgage-backed securities, $200 billion in Freddie, Fannie, and Federal Home Loan Bank bonds, and $300 billion in longer-term treasuries, mortgage rates may challenge or even better the previous low. Greenspan blamed the housing bubble on success, or in his words, the Teutonic shift in the early 1990s by much of the developing world, away from central planning to increasingly dynamic export-led market competition. The result was a surge in growth that led to an excess in saving. That in turn propelled global long-term interest rates progressively lower between 2000 and 2005, and guess who takes credit? The maestro, of course, with Greenspan quoting Milton Friedman for support. In evaluating the 1987 to 2005 period, he said, "This is not another period in which the Federal Reserve System has performed so well. It's more than a difference of degree. It approaches a difference of kind, from one diffract icon about another. His comment rings hollow, and according to Catherine Austin Fitz, the evidence is compelling from her experience as an insider. Replying to the Wall Street Journal, she explained that her company served as lead financial advisor to the Federal Housing Administration between 1994 and 1997. She watched both the administration and the Fed aggressively implement policies that engineered the housing bubble and gave an example involving scrutinizing mortgages for pooling, then repackaging them and selling them in tranches to investors. Even in 1995, she could see that these plans would create unserviceable debt load in the communities struggling with globalization caused declining incomes. The fallout would be mortgage default combined with mortgage-backed securities draining retirement savings from 401ks and pension plans. Taxpayers would get the bill, but insiders would make the money. She accused an administration official involved in the scheme with planning on issuing more mortgages than there were houses or residents. His reply, shut up, this is none of your business. It gets worse, the result of the longstanding partnership of narcotics trafficking and mortgage fraud, then combining them to target and destroy minority and poor communities with highly profitable economic warfare. The model is global and very profitable throughout the world and across America, with numerous examples of fruit. She cited one. In October 1996, Representative Maxine Waters, Democrat of California, released documents showing evidence of CIA links to the South Central Los Angeles crack epidemic, at least since the 1980s, attributed to fundraising efforts from the Nicaraguan Contras. Fitz wrote in May 1999 that in December 1997, the CIA Inspector General delivered volume one of their report to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence on the charges. It documented the continual money-laundered flow of an estimated $500 billion to $1 trillion a year into the U.S. financial system. To placate Waters, Greenspan met with her in January of 1998 and pledged billions would come to her district. It began in February when Al Gore announced it was awarded empowerment zone status and was made eligible for $300 million in federal grants and tax benefits. Fitz called Greenspan the liar and accused him of being complicit with the Treasury in engineering the housing bubble as part of a financial coup d'etat documented in her writing, Dylan Reed & Company, Incorporated, where she served as managing director and board member in the aristocracy of stock profits. She explained how America's aristocracy makes money ensnaring our youth in a pincer movement of drugs in prisons and wins middle-class support through government-funded contracts for war on drugs and activities at federal, state, and local levels. The consensus is sustained by the gush of growing debt and derivatives used to bubble the housing and mortgage markets, manipulate the stock and precious metals markets, and finance trillions missing from the U.S. government in the largest pump-and-dump in history of the entire economy. It's more than a process designed to wipe out the middle class. It's genocide, a much more subtle and lethal version than ever been perpetrated by legions of previous scoundrels. She described a process of insider deals designed to hollow out America, centralize power and knowledge, shift all the wealth to the privileged, destroy communities and local infrastructure, create new wealth by rebuilding them, and leave human despair in its wake. It's no accident that they crushed the world economies to enrich the money trust, wrecked lives, and impoverished millions, and the scheme remains very much ongoing. Yet Greenspan remains unapologetic, indeed smug in his journal op-ed. He defies blame on the global forces beyond the control of the domestic monetary policymakers, while claiming that global market competition and integration in goods, services, and finance had brought unprecedented gains in material well-being. For whom he wouldn't stay, he didn't have to, just look at the winners and the losers. Then explain it to the victims, the millions of Americans losing homes, jobs, pensions, savings, and futures, the growing numbers with inadequate safety net protection for emergencies. Explain the greatest ever economic collapse, not an accident, but willfully engineered, the lack of regulatory restraints that allowed it, and the devastating toll from its fallout. Tell those affected how the appropriate policy response is not to bridle financial intermediation with heavy regulation, but free it to save for minor reforms too little to matter and simple to remove once the heat's off. Justify the retention of a dynamic world economy capable of producing prosperity and future sustainable growth based on business-as-usual policies, ones you describe as not relying on governments to intermediate saving and investment flows, but freeing capital to grow more of its enrich the few at the expense of the rest. Justify the global economic collapse, the billions harm, the human misery, and the fear that it's just beginning. Explain how the jibs with democratic freedoms, equal opportunity, and the best of all possible worlds. At age 83, as a prominent figure, a well-paid private advisor, and a speaker, historical revisionism is how, and let the devil take the hindmost. Stephen Lindman is a research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization. He lives in Chicago, and he can be reached at ledmanstephen@sbcglobal.net.
Anyway, that was a good article. Greenspan has been a creep all these years, and nobody busted his chops, and he should.
No, and he's walked away from the destruction that he's.
It's the same thing with the Bush regime is going to walk away. The Clinton machine walked away. Everybody's walked away and left this worse and worse and worse. So let's go on. And the right wing weeps for the rich. This is by Jim Hightower.
Yeah, that's a great article.
Politicos and pundits on the right have resurrected the old bugaboo to hurl at Barack Obama's economic recovery efforts, class war. Even New York Times columnist David Brooks, the soft-spoken but steadfast defender of American corporate powers, has recently reached for this political cudgel to pound Obama's budget. He wails at the tax burden to finance such big initiatives as universal health care and energy independence is predicted on the class divide. And Brooks expresses despair that no new burdens will fall on 95% of the American people, adding that a cluck of the tongue that all of the cost will be borne by the rich and all the benefits redistributed downwards.
Aww.
Well, let us all now get a collective hug to the poor, but put upon rich, who for the last 30 years has been grabbing practically all of the financial gains generated in our economy, while the vast majority of folks have seen their real incomes decline. Then let us point out to Brother Brooks that such things as health care for all and a booming green economy actually will be of a great benefit to everyone, including the rich. Yet the Times columnist condemns promiscuous redistributionists who want to spread the wealth. With a straight face, he cries out for the conservative vision of a nation in which we are all in it together, in which burdens are all shared broadly, and rather than simply inflicted on a small minority. What a piece of work.
Yeah.
What planet has this guy been on in the last couple of decades? This small minority.
Well, one where he's received all the benefits.
Yeah, this small minority he weeps for is the same a bunch of elites who created tax dodges, trade scams, deregulation fantasies, deunionization schemes, financial hustles, and other mechanisms to distribute wealth from workaday families to them. It's about time the burden shifts upwards and the benefits of our economy become broadly shared. And high times, I agree. So, let's forget the rich bullshit. The rich bullshit doesn't exist. You know, tear them down. and the Ridiculous Class Bias in American Tax Code. Should I read that one?
Well,
read that one. I got one more, and then we'll go to our interview.
Okay, this is a good one, and it's just certain parts from this that are important that I've already outlined. The rich are truly different from you and me. They surely are, because they're treated differently. And this is from JimHightower.com. I'm not talking about the merely affluent, but the ultra-rich. Those Wall Street elites who annually pocket tens of millions of dollars each through such financial entities as hedge funds and private equity firms. While you and I earn the bulk of our money from wages or ordinary income, as economists so snobbishly call it, the richy rich don't receive anything as pedestrian as income. Oh, no, they have gains. Aside from the snoop factor, what's the difference? The tax code, folks, that's what the difference is. Our ordinary income is taxed by the feds at the rate of up to 35%. The very rich, however, who haul in most of their money from capital gains and stocks, pay only 15% on this income.
That's right. That's criminal.
Income is income, and the super rich deserve no special break, just because they make their money from money. As Warren Buffett has asked, why should billionaires investors like him pay a lower tax rate than our receptionists do or our cleaning ladies? It's a question of fundamental fairness. And I agree with that.
I do too. And I think that's where we stand on these issues. And they were great articles, I think. I was going to read something else here, but I think I'm going to go right to the interview. Yeah. And if we get time, I'll read them after the interview, but I don't think we will. So anyway, right now we have an interview with our good friend
Larry Dorman.
Larry Dorman from the AFSCME Union.
Public Affairs Coordinator for AFSCME.
Right.
Council 4 here in Connecticut.
Right. And this was recorded last night on our FM show. And you can, I'll talk to you more about that later, about checking out our shows on Tuesday nights now on the Q103.com website.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to link to that pretty soon as I figure out the details.
Did you try to do that?
Steve King, Congressman, a Republican from Indiana.
Yes.
He has a petition out, and he's very much opposing the Employee Free Choice Act,
right,
which I think we should talk about. And they seem to be putting a lot of money into trying to drum up a campaign to oppose this. And they're saying they have six areas that they're talking about that the reason they oppose it. And the first area is, it says, it denies workers the right to a secret ballot when voting on whether or not they want to be part of a big union. Can you speak to that, Larry?
Yeah, and again, a lot of myths are being propagated by big business and by the CEOs who oppose it, including.
Well, to be fair, where I got that article from was from the Newsmax, which is or Human Events or whatever. It's a very right wing.
Oh, fine. No,
but that's what's being put out, and I was very curious when I saw it, because I can see what they're saying.
And I think we need to speak to these articles, to these points.
But also, I heard the other day where Starbucks and Walmart and
Costco.
Is it Costco?
Yep.
Yeah, those three got together to try to shape this.
Right. And I think that tells you that employers are fearful. They've had such a not just an upper hand, but an unfair disadvantage. It's been disadvantageous to workers, and I think that is a sign that there's real teeth to this legislation. So,
mm-hmm.
To answer your question, it doesn't destroy secret ballot. It simply enables workers to form unions without the harassment, the intimidation, the coercion, and the law breaking that, quite frankly, goes on from corporations and the union busting firms that they hire. Mm-hmm. You still get to vote up or down on the union, but what's called the neutrality and card check process will be honored, so that when the majority of the workers have indicated they want the union, it will be there instead of going through an additional step in which allows the employer to engage in the campaign of harassment and intimidation.
Right.
And I believe the statistics are pretty stark. About 1 in 4 workers fired for exercising their right of freedom of association, meaning fired for trying to unionize. Cases take forever to get through the National Labor Relations Board. Oftentimes you see the workers upheld for either being fired or disciplined for having engaged in union organizing activity. It's supposed to be a protected activity. The reality is it's not. So the Employee Free Choice Act is precisely that. It gives employees free choice to decide whether or not they want a union at the workplace. And if they do, then there would also provide an arbitration process to allow a first contract to be negotiated and then settled. Because often there are many cases where that piece of it drags out and then the union's decertified because they don't have a contract.
Mm-hmm.
So it's simply tipping the scales towards fairness, away from abuse by the employers. And if workers don't want a union in a particular work site, they won't have one. It's that simple. So it doesn't do anything to destroy their freedom of choice and their right to a secret ballot. It just doesn't do any of that. It just tips the scales a little bit back in the favor of the workers. You mentioned Reagan.
Yeah.
There's an arc of declining wages and declining standard of living that, quite frankly, drops, can be traced right back to when Reagan fired air traffic controllers, when companies started moving offshore in the 80s and 90s, it's always been demonstrated that the middle class is strongest when there's a robust American labor movement. So that's all.
Now, I was very surprised when I heard these figures, but I remember that at that time in 1980, between 80 and 83 or so, or 84, we suddenly swelled to like 3 million homeless people,
right
under the Reagan administration, and through that recession period,
yep.
Right when Volcker was squeezing everybody at 16%,
exactly.
So, equity, 16% mortgage rates, is absolutely insane.
And that's a great point. Like I said, since the early 80s, and basically since Reagan took over and that so-called Reagan Revolution took root, the middle class has witnessed a steep decline. And you can look at statistics and show that middle class wages are higher and better and correlate to having stronger union representation in the workforce.
Yeah.
It's the basic simple premise that unions, public or private sector, unions are the rising tide that lift all boats. And so as you have a decline in unionization from a high of about 35% or so in the late 60s to about 14% or so now, you've seen a decline in the wages, the average wages of working Americans, and you've seen an increase in poverty, you've seen an increase in homelessness. All these things aren't accidents.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's so true. But the one thing that bothers me probably is I don't understand it, I would think you would want to have a secret ballot, but, that's not what they want to keep the secret ballot in. So why would you want an open ballot?
The problem isn't that it's not, it's really not a secret ballot process right now, because, again, what happens is the employees indicate that they want a union. They come in and they say, we want AFSCME. The majority sign the cards. It's clear they want a union.
Right.
What happens is that the process gets staggered, and it's almost as if you would have a presidential election twice.
Yeah.
Imagine you had a presidential election where Obama was clearly elected, but then it was going to go back to another ballot, and in the ensuing time, the Republicans had a chance to intimidate voters and harass voters and
right.
Suppress turnout, and all of a sudden, we'd end up with President McCain, and it's really that kind of crazy. It's adding a layer that is not a secret ballot. It's actually a process that allows the employer again, to intimidate, to hold closed-door meetings, to frighten employees into not voting for the union or refraining. And that's the problem, is that if it were a fair process, you know, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
Right.
But it's been clear that, you know, it's not a fair process at all. It's it advantages the employer to the extent where you have unsurpassed levels of coercion and harassment and intimidation. You have union, as I said, union-busting law firms making a pretty good buck, helping employers scare their employees. So it's really not a secret ballot. You know, I consider it just an invitation for the employer to harass workers.
Workers, unless they're in a union, don't have any access to a huge law firm to represent them and their rights.
Right. Right. So all this is doing is saying that when the employees have indicated that they want to unionize, they know which union they want to belong to, the employer should honor the process, remain neutral, and allow the final decision to hold. So, it is a secret ballot. It's simply that you're not extending the process out to have what amounts to a second election, but it's an election that's tilted, almost like in a banana republic, you know. it's a crazy quilt process.
Another scare tactic they're using is, it says, it banned companies, in effect, from running their companies during a strike, a right they have held roughly for 70 years.
Right.
And they also talk about that this attacks all 22 state right-to-work laws.
Right.
And,
you know, which is interesting, the right-to-work states, those are states where, primarily in the South and Midwest, where a union can organize the workers, but the workers will opt out. Yet they get the full representation of the union, but they're not paying as much and they're not paying in. And there's some fascinating economic data to show that in the right-to-work states, not only are workers' wages lower, but there's higher levels of poverty, lower levels, I should say, of educational achievement, lower government investment in infrastructure. So those aren't models that we want to pursue.
Right.
So how do you feel about this extra 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 10, I don't even know how many trillions of dollars now that are being dumped into the system? I mean, do you think Obama is doing a great job at this? Or do you think that it's just becoming
I think it's
a watershed?
The numbers obviously defy imagination, right?
Yeah.
Nobody predicted that the bailout money and would have to keep pouring forth, and nobody anticipated that AIG would do what they did with taking the bonus money. I think that clearly the administration, the core legislation, you know, the other economic stimulus and recovery act, I think that's a very good thing, you know, and money is going to the states, and it's going to do what it's supposed to do, which is, and the government does have the luxury of being able to print money, which states and, you know, municipalities don't have the luxury of doing. All that's understood. The point is that the Obama administration is trying to keep its commitment to getting money out into the cities and towns across America for infrastructure, for energy, for education. New Haven just got money for police services through federal stimulus. So it's out there. What I think, you know, was unforeseen and what's unparalleled is the challenges of dealing with corporations that are mismanaged, are greedy, that help spur the crisis. You know,
this
is a crisis created.
Larry, this was all created. I mean, they knew what they were doing. And they knew that
this was, you know, essentially a conspiracy among
financial
institutions,
right.
Real estate.
It's the same thing that happened in the Great Depression. The same thing. They rigged it then, and they're rigging it now.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what I think. The problem, Leo and Lila, that's the problem, is that the system has been so rigged beyond belief, and that's what I think has caused.
I mean, it's almost insane to think how it is, and yet at the same time, we have idealists like Lila and I and yourself and other people that think, well, you know, even though we have to keep shoveling through this piles of manure that keep coming down on us. You know what I mean? It's
discouraging. You know, it would be honest of me to say anything other than it's discouraging, and I don't believe that the Obama administration, particularly with this expected, for instance, this AIG mess, obviously. The problem is that you've got a stimulus package, and you've got corporations largely benefiting from it, when the real need is out in our communities, where, as you guys have noted, people are without jobs, people are losing homes, people don't have health insurance, and that's what's hard to fathom. And, you know, so much of the attention has been to companies like AIG that, you know, participated in the defrauding of taxpayers, you know. And
they keep
fraud,
just come on.
Well, I hope you think a little more globally than just these benefits that AIG is getting. I think we need to look into, as Denise Napier said. I got that article from you, that we need to look at corporate compensation overall. I mean, let's just look at the whole problem and not just one aspect of it. And I think we have to regulate it. They obviously can't handle it themselves.
They cannot, and, you know, Wall Street cannot be trusted.
No.
You know, the current system, you know, the current free market system, thanks to a lot of rollback of regulations, has helped create the mess we're in. So, people don't like to hear it, but you're exactly right. You know, we've got to get on top of what these corporations are doing. We've got to get on top of what Wall Street's doing.
Yes. I wanted to tell you what Lila and I have, and I speak for both of us in this. We've had two experts on in the last 3 or 4 weeks, economists and others who have written about and have advocated the nationalizing of banks, okay, and especially state banks.
Yep.
And these two people have already asked, have already accepted the challenge. They said, if you want to do one in Connecticut, we'll be happy to help you set it up. And go through the paperwork with it and everything else, and so you can get this thing started.
The state of North Dakota has a state bank that they incorporated in 1919, and that state is solvent. And they went through
$7 billion surplus in this economy right now.
Yeah.
Right? And that's because they fund
projects.
Their own bank, okay, and fund their own projects, and they issue their own, you know, bonds and loans and then mortgages and everything else is through the state bank. But they also have some private banks working outside. But this one handles the state treasury money, right? And lend out, you know, it's just a perfect system. It works perfectly for them. And we really, really would like to see that happen in Connecticut. And anybody in Massachusetts or New York who's listening, we could set that. You're welcome to the same
Information that we have.
And these people are willing to work with a group to put that bill on the table.
One of the things that people can do is email their state representatives and state senators regarding this.
Regarding state.
Interesting idea, and it's certainly, you know, we should have our minds open.
And the thing is that there's a template for it right in North Dakota.
Right
there. I mean, they've been doing it for 100 years.
Probably one of the most conservative states in the Union.
Right, exactly. I mean, so that's ironic.
Isn't that something?
And you only got like 700,000 people in the whole state, you know?
It's not exactly analogous, but there is something of an example closer to home, actually, which is on a much smaller scale, but it's indicative of what happens when you set up a nonprofit structure in the state of Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
They passed legislation several years ago, basically kicking the private insurance industry out of the workers' compensation business, because private insurers, as they do with health care, simply profiteering off the pain and suffering of injured workers. Rhode Island actually kicked the private companies out of the business and set up a state-administered mutual fund.
Mm-hmm.
Which the employers pay into, and actually when they have turned profits, and then that gets returned back to the employers essentially as a dividend. So Rhode Island made the decision to boot private insurance out of the workers' comp business, set up a state-administered fund. It's a nonprofit mutual insurance corporation, and the shareholders are, guess who, the businesses that have to provide workers' compensation coverage to their members.
That worked works out for them. And that's, I think, a model that we should be looking at on a much broader scale. Companies are the source of all our problems.
Right.
And, you know, it's their greed, it's their indifference, it's their...
But the banks, the banking system as it is now, the Federal Reserve, but the Federal Reserve is absurd. I mean, we can't keep allowing these banks to feed these banks.
Look at how many banks have collapsed.
Yeah, all of them. And these are all Federal Reserve banks.
Right.
You know, these are all the cream of the crop banks. You know what I mean?
And, you know, people's assets.
Too big to fail, you know.
I just think that's...
Well, they were just gambling with people's money, that's all.
We really do have to pursue those kinds of ideas, such as the one you mentioned, because...
And I think we have to pursue criminal action against, pursuing... some kind of a criminal prosecution against these bankers.
Yep.
They just got to go after them. I mean, this stuff is treason here.
Usable.
It's treason.
And it should be treated. You know, you go after workers when they steal from the company.
They put them behind bars.
They've stolen from the company.
Sure.
They've stolen from the taxpayers.
Yeah.
Well, I'm angry when I'm trying to, my wife and I are trying to figure out how the heck we're going to put our kids through college.
Yeah.
We're having a rough time with that, and then I've got to read about my tax dollars going to these corporate pigs. I'm angry. It just makes you angry. It would have been better off to take the AIG money and just give each working person a tax break. Because you know what? I'm going to spend my money the way you guys spend it. I'm going to, like, purchase things in my neighborhood and in my town, in my state, you know. I'm going to circulate money in my local economy, or, you know, I'll use it to pay tuition at a Tungus Community College for my daughter. It just angers me that we're taking all these taxpayer dollars from you and me and giving it to companies that don't do anything to put it back in the community.
Right, and on top of that, they don't even pay taxes. Many of these companies have not paid their federal taxes.
Yeah.
On top of everything else.
And I just think it is obviously, you know, far bigger and much worse than I imagine the president thought. And look, I think a lot of people on both sides of the aisle were complicit.
Oh, yeah. I think so, too.
You know,
and
but
that's what
now the issue is, you know, what's good news is they're moving to try and deal with that issue of the so-called toxic assets, which they just have to, you know, which is probably what threatens the economy. And then, you know, maybe we can actually start investing in programs that put people to work the way, you know, Roosevelt did and with the New Deal.
Well, at least his plan for the toxic economy had a positive effect on the stock market.
That was
heartening to see. Let's hope that's sustained.
Let's be real, too. Most of us don't, you know, our stock market to us means our, you know,
it's our pension.
Our 401k.
That's right.
And so it's really frightening to think that, people, working class people have taken these hits on what was supposed to be there for a secure retirement. So, we need more regulation. We need more governance, corporate governance. We need to do something about the runaway compensation packages. So I'm glad you brought up the piece. People should Google, Denise Napier. And, her point was really well taken.
I thought so.
You know, we make a mistake if we just focus on AIG and not the larger system.
And I think she's absolutely right. People have to keep that in mind.
By the way, the state treasurer, Denise Napier, is a real role model in terms of her prudent investing, in terms of the fact that while every public pension fund is taking a hit, Connecticut, I think, is not taking quite the hit that other states have, and she's really doing a remarkably good job acting as a steward of public pension dollars. I'm really quite impressed with her, and I think it's really refreshing to hear a public official, you know, instead of equivocating and trying to cover up, saying that we've got to do something about the corporate governance structure. She's pushed a lot of shareholder rights resolutions, but at the same time, the various investment vehicles that the state treasurer administers have performed quite well. So, you know, she's very, she places great emphasis on social responsibility investing, and she places a lot of emphasis on accountability. So that's really refreshing.
Yeah, she wants to have shareholders have the right to vote in executive pay, and I thought that was also a good thing.
Right. I mean, you work in a school system where, you know, the programs you see and the kids you see are in danger of being cut.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you're working as hard as you ever did. The people we represent work very hard. Something's fundamentally wrong when we're rewarding these companies for failing and then stealing our money. that's what we're talking about.
And you know, the other thing that's amazing is Americans, I was just looking at this, Americans are increasing their rate of savings.
Right.
All right. From zero, which was 2 years ago, to 5% now.
Right.
All right. So that's good, actually. I mean, I think that's a good sign that people are taking responsibility.
It is, but you know, as I say, I think the big problem is maybe it's the contrast that I'm trying to draw, which is that at the local and state level, we're talking about cutting human services, social services, services for unemployed people, job training.
Right.
We're cutting art programs, music programs, recreation programs in high schools. Why are we cutting? Because we've got a crazy quilt, inequitable tax structure that basically has allowed the AIGs of the world and the Aetnas of the world and their executives to profiteer at our expense. And I think something's dreadfully wrong when we're talking about cutting trash pickup and talking about cutting paraprofessionals and instructional aides at schools, but we somehow can subsidize these corporate pigs. Something's wrong.
And when they say, it was really something when they said they couldn't break those contracts. Boy, they don't have any trouble breaking union contracts if they want to.
We're unfortunately at the bargaining table in multiple communities being asked to
revisit, as they like to call it, right?
What's that?
Revisit the contract.
Well said, Myla. Well said.
Revisit.
Open up your wallets and
yes.
More. Working people are being asked to, dip into their pockets to solve a problem they didn't create. And, that troubles me. We can't break these corporate contracts, but you're right. Governor Rell has got the state unions at the table reopening their health and pension agreement and their wage agreements, and it's happening in all the municipalities. And, kind of like subsidizing a party you don't get to attend.
Yeah, try to balance the budget on the very poorest of the people.
Right, and that's why I think Leo's image and metaphor, which was very real, is probably a good one to close on. That real people are suffering out there, and I think that's what distinguishes this economic crisis from previous downturns that we've seen in the last 20 or 30 years. Middle class and upper middle class wage earners are going to social service offices looking for help. That's never happened before. And affluent places like, suburban and, San Diego, you see these homeless camps. It's real.
When you put face on it, it's one thing to talk about numbers and it's another thing to talk about cuts, but when you see families living in a tent city,
right,
and you look at their faces, and you just think, that could be me.
Right.
No, they were once proud middle-class families, and...
See, the people that had good jobs.
Yeah,
The good news, I think, is that, we're out there, the unions are out there fighting. I think the president is absolutely aware of the anger, and unlike his predecessor, he's trying to channel it into something positive instead of ignoring it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I'm beyond blind faith at this point. I mean, we really got nothing left to do other than just...
You're right.
I'm
not going to argue that point.
Yeah, it's not even faith.
I think he genuinely believes that America is not headed in the right direction, and that, when working class people can't survive and can't send their kids to school, that something's fundamentally wrong, and that's at least a major distinction from the previous administration.
So that's great. But Larry, you leave on one. You got an upbeat note there. Or you got a.
Actually, I know that the distance issue is great when for you guys out in the northwest quarter of the state. But we are organizing. We are mobilizing. There's a lot of good things happening. We have a big rally in Hartford tomorrow called Better Choices for Connecticut. It's all kinds of community advocates. We're going to be rallying for a better, fairer revenue system in Connecticut.
Where is this now?
It's going to be 4:30 tomorrow at the State Capitol grounds and Capitol Avenue in Hartford. And
mm-hmm.
I invite, if your listeners want to come down, there's going to be a lot of people talking about and telling the governor not to cut services, and that you don't, in a recession, in an economic crisis, the last thing you do is cut services and make things worse. So I think people are really banding together like they haven't before, and that's what makes me encouraged.
Good, and I wish great success for rally tomorrow.
I'll report back to you guys, and we'll talk about it next time.
That's good.
Good, we look forward to hearing from you.
You both be well.
Thank you, and you too, Larry. Thanks for being with us. That was Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator for Council 4 AFSCME, a union for all municipal employees.
Yeah, nice guy.
Very
nice. And good operation.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to go on. Our guest, John Brennan's going to be coming up at 9:30 tonight. He's got going to be talking. Oh, he's got an Irish joke for us. And,
good.
And he's he told it to me, and it was very funny. And I said we must say it on the air. So, but since Layla and I know the punchline, we just
don't tell.
Right, it's a good one though. It's worth waiting for Johnny
for
at 9:30, and he's got some interesting information.
It's time for our station ID, Leo.
This is www.
Set it out there, Leo.
Yeah, he's.
Yeah, so anyway, that was our show last night, and on Q103.3, our FM flagship show. And we wanted to say that there were a couple other things that I wanted to talk about possibly tonight, that we have some time. I think I got time for one more article. And something came up here that I'm trying to find the article at. And let's see, it will be here in a second. Let's see, we have, I wanted to talk about Geithner for a minute. There was a couple of good articles that came up recently on him, and I just might want to mention it. This was from actually Yahoo Finance. And it says, Geithner's plan, extremely dangerous. Part one, actually, and it's from economist Galbraith, says, and this was dated March 23rd, from the Business Insider, Tim Geithner has finally revealed his plan to fix the banking system and economy. Paul Krugman, James Galbraith, and others have already trashed it. Why? In short, because the plan is yet another massive ineffective gift to banks, and Wall Street taxpayers, of course, will take the hit. Why does Tim Geithner keep repackaging the same trash asset removal plan that he has been trying to get approved since last fall? In our opinion, because Tim Geithner formed this view of this crisis last fall, while sitting across the table from his constituents at the New York Fed, the CEOs of the big Wall Street firms, he views the crisis the same way Wall Street does, as a temporary liquidity problem, and his plan to fix it are designed with the best interests of Wall Street in mind. If Geithner's plan to fix the banks would also fix the economy, this would be tolerable, but no smart economist we know of thinks that it will. We think Geithner is suffering from five fundamental misconceptions about what is wrong with the economy, and here they are. The trouble with the economy is that banks aren't lending. The reality, the economy is in trouble because American consumers and businesses took on way too much debt and are now collapsing under the weight of it. As consumers retrench, companies that sell to them are retrenching, thus exacerbating the problem. The banks, meanwhile, are lending. They just aren't lending as much as they used to. Also, the shadow banking system, the securitization markets, which actually provided more funding to the economy than the banks, has collapsed. And the banks aren't lending because their balance sheets are loaded with bad assets. And the market has temporarily mispriced the reality. The banks aren't lending much because they have decided to stop making loans to people and companies who can't pay them back, and because the banks are scared that future write-downs on their old loans will lead to future losses that will wipe out their equity. Bad assets are bad because the market doesn't understand how much they are really worth. The reality, the bad assets are bad because they are worthless, worth less than the banks say they are. House prices have dropped by nearly 30% nationwide. That has created something in the neighborhood of a five plus trillion of lo- five five $1 trillion of losses in residential real estate alone. Off-peak market value of housing, about $20 trillion. And the banks don't want to take their share of those losses because doing so will wipe them out. So they and Geithner are doing everything they can to pawn the losses off on the taxpayer. So you're kind of getting the point here that Geithner is screwing around, but not for the people. More for, he's a Wall Street man. And once we get the bad assets of bank balance sheets, the banks off bank balance sheets, the banks will start lending again. The reality is that the banks will remain cautious about lending because the housing market and economy are still deteriorating. So they're still, so they'll sit there and say they are lending while waiting for the economy to bottom. Once the banks start lending, the economy will recover. The reality, American consumers still have debt coming out of their ears, and they'll be working it off for years. House prices are still falling. Retirement savings have been crushed. Americans need to increase their savings rate from today's 5%, a vast improvement from the 0% rate of 2 years ago, to the 10% long-term average. Consumers don't have room to take on more debt, even if the banks are willing to give it to them. And the two charts from Ned Davis illustrate the real problem, an explosion of debt relative to GDP. And the first is non-financial debt to GDP, and the second is total debt to GDP. In Geithner's plan, this debt won't disappear. It will just be passed from banks to taxpayers, where it will sit until the government finally admits that a major portion of it will never be paid back. And those are the reasons. And you can check this out at yahoo.com /tech/ticker/article. Yeah. So anyway, it's in there. You heard it here first, or second, but anyway, you heard it here. So anyway, that's where we're ending tonight. I don't know if I have time to read much more. It's got about a minute and a half or so left. Please join us tomorrow night. I've been doing a series recently. I started it last week, and I think I'm going to continue it tomorrow. I've been reading some lectures by Manly P. Hall, and I'm going to continue that series next tomorrow night. And we're going to discuss a number of his, another one of his essays, and possibly I'll probably read the essay tomorrow as I did the last one. It looked like I got a great response to last week. I appreciate everyone who's listened to the Manly P. Hall Jesus Wept lecture. And tomorrow night, I'm not certain which one I'm going to do. I have a couple in mind, but I guarantee it will be a good one. And I hope you join us then. And in the meantime, and on Friday night, of course, we'll be talking with Georgia Dixon. We'll be discussing the Mayan calendar and, of course, the ascension consciousness and a number of remarkable issues. So join us then. And in the meantime, we want to thank you and hope you had a good time tonight. Tell your friends about us and talk to you next week. Yeah, talk to you tomorrow night when I discuss. When I read another essay by Manly P. Hall. And good night.